This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
We are talking the Melody Buzzard case first this morning. A missing 9-year-old, a mother in handcuffs, an arrest that raises far more questions than it actually answers. 9-year-old Melody Buzzard disappeared after that cross-country trip with her mother, Ashley Buzzard. The trip that Ashley is saying nothing about as to why she went on it or where her daughter went. Surveillance footage shows wigs, rental car, and a quiet return home without Melody. Now we're weeks into this, and Ashley has finally been arrested, but on felony false imprisonment charges that authorities say is not connected to her daughter's disappearance. Okay, so what's really going on here? Was this a strategic arrest, a way to keep her in custody while the investigation unfolds, or something darker tied to what happened on that trip? To help us make sense of it, defense attorney Bob Mata is with us, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. We're breaking down what the charges mean here, what it doesn't, and whether law enforcement's careful wording on this hints at something much bigger is going on behind the scenes. Let's start with this, Bob, on this the charge itself that everybody is talking about that she's been arrested on. False imprisonment, and apparently not directly connected to Melody. What does that legally entail, and what does it tell you from a defense attorney standpoint?
Well, I mean, the charge itself is pretty basic. It's essentially that you're keeping somebody against their will. Like if I were to lock you in a room and you felt as if you weren't allowed to leave that room, that's false imprisonment. So, the charge itself is unusual because we don't know really any of the facts. I mean, I know there's been a couple of people that have come out and talked, and I think the alleged victim said something, but I don't really understand what it is, which tells me more in terms of that careful wording that you were talking about. This is very much a prosecutorial strategic move in order to, as you said, either get her off the streets, which to me is a curious decision in the sense that, frankly, I think that she may be more helpful in locating Melody if she was out as opposed to being stuck in a cell, just in terms of maybe communicating with people. But it also tells me that they believe that that Melody probably is not alive.
Because and the bail too, the bail being so high, they don't want her out.
Right. She's never going to be able to post that. Mm-mm. So, it's a curious move. I mean, it's a flex in some ways in terms of her not cooperating. I think that that's clearly them saying, hey, all right, well, okay, good. We're going to show you, this is what we could do over here in the interim. And, good luck with that.
It makes you wonder if they ran out of patience with her, because she has been free this whole last month, literally about a full month between the daughter going missing, or we don't know where the hell she is, and this arrest taking place. Let's talk about the absurdity of that in itself. But it is how the system works. The fact that me or you, we both have children, in theory, one of us could take our own child, drive somewhere and tell no one where we're going, drop that kid off, and don't have to reveal where we dropped them off, why we dropped them off. All we have to do is say, I don't have them anymore, but they're safe, and return home. And there's nothing you can do to arrest that parent. That's literally how our system works. That's kind of shocking, because if you have some sort of mental health crisis going on, or if you're a horrible, evil human being, that pretty much allows you to make a child disappear with very little questions asked until someone really, really pushes.
Yeah, I think the exception to that, like, say, for instance, if her biological father hadn't died in that motorcycle crash, before she was even born, I believe that was, and they hadn't been married, he certainly could, he could certainly push the envelope in terms of saying, "Hey, well, she's kidnapped my kid. She's not telling me where my child is."
But so beyond that,
that circumstance, they'd be able to do something. In this circumstance, where she is the sole guardian provider of that child, it's a really, really weird situation. Allie and I were kind of pontificating when we did a live about it as to whether or not they should employ the Lori Vallow approach, where it's CPS that comes in and CPS basically files something on behalf of the state, wherein they're going and telling the judge, "We think something nefarious has gone on here. We want the kid produced so that we can investigate." And the judge then orders, you know, her to produce the children on said date. And if she doesn't do that, then you say, okay, well, you're now being held in contempt of court, or, you violated the court order. We're taking you in on it. Somebody in our chat said that they thought that they had done that. I haven't seen any evidence that they did do that. To me, I would have preferred that approach, to be honest with you, because then at least it puts the pressure back on her, even if she's not talking. You know, if there's something that can take place wherein, for whatever set of circumstances, Melody is alive and well, that forces her hand to say, "All right, well, you know, I'm gonna give up where she is," or she goes and retrieves her and brings her back and produces her at that time. You know, otherwise they toss her in then. You know what I'm saying? But I don't know if that was actually done. Like I said, somebody in our chat said that it was done, but I haven't seen any reports about that at all.
And it's another lever to pull, and they should be pulling it, but the reality of that lever too is also kind of asinine as well in terms of how that functions. This is an emergency. There is a missing child. So this would be, okay, now we're going to set a date where you have to produce the child. It's like saying the house is on fire over here. Oh, the fire department, we called them. Well, oh, look, they bought, look, isn't that cute? They got a little garden shovel out of a Happy Meal from 1987. They're going to dig a well. They're going to dig a well with that shovel over here in the neighbor's lawn. Once they've reached water, the water table, then they're going to take buckets of it, and they're going to kind of use the Halloween bucket from McDonald's and kind of throw that under the fire, and hopefully that puts it out. That's about as effective as that would be, because essentially when it worked in the Vallow trial, they found one of the kids melting in a bucket in the backyard.
Yep, that's right. You know, but they had to go to Hawaii to grab her.
Yes, right. And she's in Hawaii.
Yeah, she's been married to Chad in Hawaii at the time. Yeah. So without a care in the world, you know. So she, you know, it's like it's a really puzzling case, man. I mean, we were digging into it, just kind of logistics of it in terms of that 3,000 miles traveled in 3 days. It's just it's a really really weird case, man. And I'm trying to understand if it is something that happened with her in terms of, you know, just some kind of mental illness, if she's got paranoid schizophrenia. I don't know. You know, it's like trying to understand what the hell is going on here is weird. And, you know, we were trying to devil's advocate it and say, okay, well, let's try to figure out a scenario in which Melody's alive, that she is just trying to protect the child, you know, but the thing that we kept running up against with that particular scenario is, okay, you left Melody with a trusted friend, right? Okay, well, what trusted friend is sitting around watching this shit transpire on, you know, the national news and just sitting there remaining quiet? Like any normal person would be like, I'm out.
Unless they're off the grid somehow and they don't know that there's this entire hoopla going on behind the scenes. I mean, all they have to do is produce the child and all of this stuff goes away.
Well, why would she, if that's the case too, why would she not just go and give an explanation? So look, I'm doing this off the record to the public. Here's what's going on. Here's why my child is here. I'm protecting the child from something or whatever it may be. There could be logical reasons here. They're few and far between, and to not reveal any of them to law enforcement to make all of this go away makes no sense.
Yeah.
Unless there is some sort of mental health thing going on here as well. But we're also sitting here in a world where it's been 30 days and there's nothing that would compel her or force her to get any sort of mental health evaluation either. We right. just sit and wait for the crazy person to do more crazy things and hope something that she does is crazy enough that we can say, oops, you crossed a line. Now we're going to have to put you in prison, which it looks like she did in some way, shape, or form of false imprisonment, which we don't know exactly what that means because right. it can mean something just as simple as, I'm not going to let you leave the room. Oh, there we go. Someone said you did this.
Right.
Come on. You're coming with us.
That thing is, they've so carefully worded that. Mm-hmm. And they have been so careful to pronounce to the public that it has nothing to do with Melody's case. And they do that obviously purposely because they don't want to have this situation where if they unfortunately discover Melody and her remains, God forbid that's the case, and then they arrest her for that, they can't have her have that be connected in terms of they're going to incorporate that somehow into the crime because it does create some legal issues in terms of what they could charge her with. Mm-hmm. So like they're really trying to keep that separate and apart. You know what I'm saying? Because it does create, I don't necessarily know that it's going to be a double jeopardy issue, but it does create other issues legally in terms of, you know, how they handle that case moving forward and what exactly they can charge him with. And if you're her defense counsel now, you know, there's an interesting question on how do you handle this particular charge? Do you go full bore in terms of defending this false imprisonment claim, or do you kind of just say, all right, well, you know, we'll plead out on it, which I don't think is going to be the answer for the defense because that's just a bad look. Like if you're pleading out to something like that, it's showing that you know she's kind of unhinged and that mm-hmm. she's got these things going on, which is just going to not bode well for her down the road in the event that they're able to locate Melody in terms of just how it looks. You know, so I don't know, man. It is a really, really bizarre case.
Let's talk for a moment about if we're talking about being unhinged here, the logistics of the trip itself. I know you and Allie were talking about this the other day on Defense Diaries. The logistics of doing this trip, like you said, I don't know the exact numbers in front of me, but it's like 3,000 miles in 3 days.
Yep.
It's quite a feat. Even, you know, if you're prepared to do this, you'd be like, shit, I'm going to, you know, that would be a hard trip. That would be a hard trip to go on.
Be rough.
And do it sanely and not fall asleep and be able to pull off that many miles. It seems rather manic to me of someone who would be able to pull that off.
Right.
It doesn't seem like it's a healthy brain that would be able to pull that off. Right. I mean, or unless you're a crazily experienced trucker, which you'd be violating all the trucking laws as well. It's like somebody took a whole case of 5-hour energy and then it lasted them 3 days.
Yeah.
And no stops for the bathroom.
And no
either.
Stops. I mean, that's the crazy part of it. I'm wondering, do we know for sure that she went on this entire trip that it was her on the trip the whole time with Melody? Do we know that as a certainty? Or is there a possibility that somewhere along the way, someone else may have gotten in this car and continued that journey and came back with the vehicle?
I mean, the last that we know that she was caught on video was on the 9th. And at that point, Melody was with her still. Like, so whatever that footage is, and I don't know if that's been leaked out to the public yet, but it's certainly been discussed that that was, you know, in terms of the state kind of putting a timeline together for the public, that was the last time she was seen. And that is on the return trip, right? So that is after she's already gotten to Nebraska, turned around and was heading back. So, I mean, if there was somebody who she was able to convinced to say, hey, can you help me complete this trip? I mean, we don't know about it yet.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, so it's like, but that was the same thing I was just puzzling. That was puzzling to me was this concept that she was able to pull it off, you know, because it, like, you figure, all right, she's going to have to stop for gas. Like there's no question about that. 3,000 miles, you figure 300 to 400, maybe 500, you know, to the full tank, you know, you're figuring six tanks. She's going to have to stop six times at least, plus bathroom breaks, unless, you know, they're pissing in bottles or I don't know, diaper, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there had to have been stops along the way. I'm confident that that's exactly what law enforcement is doing. They know the route. So they're stopping, I'm sure, at every gas station along that entire route and saying, all right, did you see this person? Now the question then becomes, you know, was she using a debit or a credit card, you know, at the pump itself? They're then, you know, pouring through the bank records, which will be helpful in terms of locating where she actually stopped. They're then going in. But again, time is your enemy. You know, I mean, you're going in a month later and saying, hey, do you still have the video from this date?
Right.
Because we need to look at it. And do you have video that is out, you know, where the tanks are? Or is it just inside where the convenience store is? So, you know, or did you speak to her? Did she come in? Did she seem normal? Was she acting normal? Was she seeming off to you? Was there, you know what I'm saying? Like, all those things have to be happening now where they're trying to figure out where the hell Melody could be, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's got to be an incredibly challenging endeavor, because it doesn't appear, at least from the maps that I've been able to pull up in terms of what her course was, that she went off course drastically one way or another, say to like a national park, you know, or somewhere that she's off route for, you know, a half an hour, and then she goes back on route and continues back home. You know, I didn't see anything like that, but I don't know if we're getting the full details of every movement that they know that she made at this point. You know, it's like they're just kind of showing, you know, the 8 states that she ended up traveling through in total and kind of the route that she took. But, you know, again, law enforcement is not necessarily going to tell us everything. And as we know, that's just not how they operate. So, I mean, it's one of those cases. And when we covered it, I'm like, why isn't anybody talking about this case?
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you think about the little Emmanuel Haro case, it's like I couldn't go anywhere without hearing about that case. Right. I didn't hear about this case until literally the day that we did a live on it, which is just bizarre to me. You know, like why isn't this one picking up, like the national media picking this one up like any other missing children or child case? I don't know. It's just a really strange thing, because we know that, you know, the school that she had enrolled Melody in was the one who finally reported her, you know, to law enforcement, saying, hey, like, we haven't seen this kid in days. Mm-hmm. I think it was on the 14th. So, you know, I mean, that's a long time to go, you know, and like, I'm sure that law enforcement went and tried to talk to her. You know, she gets stonewalled. They get the first warrant. They go in. You know, and then they eventually come back with more warrants. They go back in the house. They go to the storage locker, and then they get the vehicle. But, you know, again, 3 weeks had passed in terms of the rental. So, you know, that car's probably gone out 3 or 4 or more times since the thing was returned. So in terms of whatever they may have found, unless they're able to find biological evidence in there that she wasn't able to clean, you know, it's like, I don't know how much value that's going to be to them. So, yeah, it's a challenging case for law enforcement, for sure.
And the wigs, you know, that's something that people are talking about with this case, the purple hair and things like that. She could have just been eccentric. I know people who wear wigs all the time.
Yeah.
But when you start putting all of this evidence together and the missing child, now it's starting to stack. It's not making sense.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that family has come out that she was like a wig wearer. We actually have a friend that wore wigs all the time. Like every time we went out, she always had a different wig on. She liked wearing wigs. You know, again, when we start trying to think of a reasonable explanation, it, for me, it always falls back onto that she's suffering from some kind of mental break, whether, you know, to me, the most common sense mental issue would be that like kind of paranoid schizophrenia, wherein I could see a situation where, you know, when you, when you're suffering from that particular disorder or that disease, you know, you think that people are out to get you, and it is vivid. It is real. And that would include law enforcement and people with guns and people that are coming from the government. So I like that would help explain why she might not be willing to talk to law enforcement. But then again, you know, we have to have that situation where if it's a trusted friend that is off grid and still, you know, she's coming and saying, you know, I think the government's after me, or I think they're after Melody. Like, you have to take her for me because I think they're trying to kill her. You know, does that person not realize that she's going through something? You know, it's like I've, you know, I've had a friend who actually I went to law school with who disclosed after our first year of law school that she had actually been enrolled the year prior, but that she was a paranoid schizophrenic, but had been medicated and was taking her medication up until the point where she started law school, at which time she's like, you know what? I think I'm good. I think I'm cured of this thing, which is a common problem with that particular diagnosis, because a lot of times when people are taking their meds and they work, they're very effective for that particular mental illness. They then confuse that with being cured. Yep. And then they get off their meds, and then it comes back. You know,
that cycle starts over again.
Exactly. So it's a really weird case, man.
And the real difficult thing with that, and I want you to speak to the legalities of it, because I think it's one of those things, and people are not aware of that. This is how our system works until they're seeing it in action and going, oh, it doesn't work now, does it? There's the hands are tied so tightly of those that care about the person with the disability, with the mental illness going on here. There's only so much they can do. The grandparents, the aunts, uncles, anybody. I mean, unless you're like the spouse that's living there or has some sort of custody of the child, there's not a whole lot you can do to get that person help. That person needs to seek help, and they need to be presenting themselves as a danger to themselves or others before any sort of meaningful interaction can take place. And if none of that is being demonstrated, this is how she's able to live, because people are asking, how was she able to be, you know, the family said 2-3 years ago there was problems and that she's living in squalor and there's clearly something wrong with her, but nothing was done. Well, because nothing can be done in a lot of ways. Is that correct?
That is correct. I mean, and you nailed it on the head. It's that situation wherein, unless she's a threat to herself or others, there's nothing you can do. There's absolutely nothing you can do in terms of especially getting her in to do like a 72-hour hold. You know, I mean, there has to be a trigger for that. You just can't have her family calling in and saying, okay, well, she's not talking to us anymore, or, you know, she's not allowing us to see my grandchild or my niece. You know, those kind of things aren't going to trigger them saying, well, it sounds like a family issue. You know, that's not a law enforcement issue. You know, if she does something wherein she's threatened harm to somebody else or herself or her child, and you're aware of it, that changes the scenario. At that point, we can step in. But until something like that happens, their hands are tied. You know, I mean, they can't get her in.
And I think this happens quite often. I've heard so many stories of families trying to intervene where they know their loved one, their son, their daughter, their whatever, they're suffering. There's something really going on. And there may not be necessarily your traditional threats of violence or hurting or harming themselves or others, but they know this person's one step away. And they know just the right words not to use to trigger that. And there's nothing law enforcement can do, because it's up to that person to get help. It's a very broken, flawed part of our system. Yeah. If somebody is experiencing something like that, I mean, I don't know. I mean, here's what I would do. And you tell me, I mean, from a human standpoint, not talking from a legal standpoint, if I know my kid, and I'm not criticizing the family here, but if I know my daughter, if, God forbid, years from now, she's in her 20s, 30s, whatever it may be, and I know there's something really mentally wrong, with her, or God forbid there's a child involved in something that was going on, and she's not necessarily using that language, I think I'd be going to law enforcement saying she is.
Yeah.
I think I'd be lying. I think I'd be like, look, she said this to me because it's my word against hers at that point, and then maybe something can get done. It feels like that is the only lever that families can use. I mean, it's not technically legally right, but if you have no choice and the system is working against the self, the existence of that person surviving, and you know that there's such a risk there, I feel like there's not many choices families have other than to say that the person is making these sort of threats of harm, because there's nothing that else can be done until they actually do go through with it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's definitely an approach. Whether or not it'll end up with her being admitted somewhere. Yeah,
I mean, at this point, I think it's the ship has sailed. This should have been a lever that they pulled prior to any of this happening. Yeah. But again, it's pretty sick like that they would have to go down that road to get help for her.
Yeah, I mean, and to your point, it sounds like from some of the interviews of the family that I've seen, she has been suffering from mental illness.
Yeah,
you know, and whether or not that predated her, you know, the biological father's death, mm-hmm. you know, who she was in a relationship with, and from all accounts, she took it very, very hard, and you know, like that was her first interaction with CPS, where they went out there and she was living like an animal. You know, the house was filthy, there was rotten food all over the place. She was neglecting the child, so like that happened, so. You know, the question that I would have if I'm the family is like you said, is this something that predated it? Is this mm-hmm. something that I knew that was going on with my kid, like even when she was younger, you know, and at that point, you know, like you said, without really pointing fingers at the family, you know, if I were to become aware of the fact that one of my four kids was suffering mentally, and I didn't take it upon myself to be realistic about that prospect. Because I mean, look, nobody's happy to find out that your child, who is the most important thing in your world, is ill, you know, mm-hmm. especially mentally ill. You know, I think there's an aspect of denial there a little yeah. bit. And, you know, there's a lot of reticence about, you know, well, do I want to, you know, now put her somehow in the system, you know, and where mm-hmm. I don't necessarily trust that either. I mean, it's a very difficult circumstance, you know, but I'm sure that law enforcement has been able to get as much medical history as they can from the family, you know, without violating HIPAA laws in terms of just trying to get background of like what's been going on with her, you know, because I mean, I know she was estranged from all of the family from the biological father for years. And from what I've read, it sounds like she was estranged from her own family as well. Yeah. She was just kind of a loner out there, man. And, you know, but like, that's that thing where I'm always thinking like, all right, this is the me against me and Melody against the world situation. And like yeah. Melody is like her ride or die, you know, it's yeah. like the only person in the world that she trusts and cares for and loves in that way. And which makes it harder for me to believe that, you know, she did something to harm her, but then you can't know, you know,
that there's a mental health crisis.
I mean, if that crisis is going on, yeah, I mean, you would think that she wouldn't want to do that. But if the voices are telling her, you know, just like Lori Vallow Daybell,
exactly.
that those kids go from, you know, they're the most important thing in the world, but now they're zombies. And yeah. the best thing, God wants you to kill them so they can go work at Costco in heaven yeah. Because they're short a stalker. And that happens at the Costco in heaven. Just ask Lori. And then, you know, kill the kids and, you know, put them in the backyard. But it's all justified because the crazy thinking.
Yeah.
that everybody has seen, but we can't do anything about because we have laws that protect the ill, and it's good that we have them, but they've gone to the point where they enable the illness. They do not protect the person from it anymore until yeah. it's too late, and that's yeah. the big problem.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like we talked about last week, we talked about a case wherein, you know, we know that the victim in that particular case was suffering from mental illness, and that, you know, her mother had called in. We're talking about the Sean Grayson case last week, which is a really good episode that people should go back and watch. You know, and in that particular situation, the mother had called in, and Sonia was a grown woman, you know, but she still said, look, you know, my daughter's going through something mentally, and, you know, I just want to make law enforcement aware of it. It was almost that situation, but in that situation, it was true, you know, but at that point she wasn't a danger to herself or others, you know? So again, nothing happened. When mom called, Sonia ended up checking herself in, you know, for a 30-day trip to find out if they could help her. And she ended up checking herself out in 2 days. And then ultimately what happened there. And it's, yeah, it's a frustrating thing, man. I mean, we don't have institutions like we used to. Like, you know, like the places like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest do not exist anymore. You know? And it's so like, where do these folks go? You know, like what do you do with people that are suffering from these types of mental issues and mental health problems? Like where do they go? Where do you put them? Like
that's why we have the homeless problems that we have. And then we blame it on affordable housing, and it's all a mental health problem. It's not housing. It's mental health.
Right.
And until we tackle that and get these people healthy, they will continue to be on the streets.
100%.
That's how it works.
100%.
Yeah, it's so frustrating, and there's so I hope that I don't feel this is going to end well, but we'll find out.
I mean, we never do. Like, you know what I mean? It's like I've never gone into one of these things feeling like it's going to end well. You know what I mean?
Sometimes we're surprised, but unless there's somebody off the grid that is just completely clueless, I don't know. I don't know how this ends, and God, there's just so many questions. Let's move on.
It's a different set of circumstances than, you know, if she was coming with a story that somebody snatched my kid, right? Yeah. Like a Susan Smith type situation. Or, you know, and when Allie and I were talking about the other night, we were like, there's a lot of parallels to what was going on when Gabby Petito went missing, when Brian Laundrie shows back up.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's like, well, where's Gabby? And he's like, oh, I don't know. Like, we got in an argument. And, you know, I came back and I left. I don't know where she is, you know, and the whole fucking world's looking for Gabby, you know, and then ultimately, sadly, they find her. But it was the same thing, you know.
And the whole world is like, you can't arrest somebody for this? No, turns out you can't.
Right. Yeah, like they're not sure a crime has been committed at this point. Yeah. So, and like the other thing, like when we first heard about the story, Allie and I were like, we were kind of laying in bed and we were reading through some of the documentation and we're like, what? I'm like, she's like, I'm like, what the fuck is going on here? She's like, what are you talking about? She's like, there's nothing. Like, she's like, if I want to take my kid and go somewhere and I'm going to leave it with my, you know, leave the kid with my friends, like, what the fuck's wrong with that? I'm like, well, you know, you don't have the other factors here. You don't have like all the other things that predated that in terms of bizarre behavior that is like raised everybody's red flags in terms of what the fuck is going on here. And I'm like, that's a different situation. You know, if it's a situation where you're like friends are saying, hey, you know, we just had the baby. We haven't done anything for ourselves in a month, you know, or a year rather. And, you know, would you watch the baby for a weekend? We're going to go do a quick weekend trip down to Mexico. And they drop the baby off without telling anybody, you know, that they're dropping the baby off. Yeah, I mean, of course you can do that, you know, but this isn't a fucking situation.
It feels entirely preventable, and it's been enabled by laws that sane people have put in place that enable the insane to do whatever they're going to do.
Yeah.
That's the frustrating part of the whole damn thing. Sane people enabled this sort of behavior to take place and to fester and to do whatever it's going to do because we wanted to protect the rights of the insane person.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the other things I want to talk about.
Who's insane in that equation?
You know? Right. I mean, exactly. I mean, therein lies the rub. And the other part of this is that I think that people are incredibly frustrated with the fact that she's not cooperating. You know what I mean? Like it's that darn Fifth Amendment right to, you know, not self-incriminate yourself that is stopping them from being able to fucking make her talk, you know? And it's like, it's that thing where people are like, okay, that right is super important. We get it. But there's a fucking child missing. Like, we have, there's got to be some kind of workaround, and there's just, there's not.
Waterboard the bitch. if your the kid's missing, do whatever the hell you need to do. Let's go to the store and get a car battery and see what, at this point, yeah, I mean, there needs to be some sensible laws where that deal with the in-between, that deal with the gray area, because 99% of the cases land in the gray area. They don't land in the absolute of where the law is designed to be, this way or that way. It's somewhere in here. And when everything lands in there and we have no answer for how to handle it, you get this.
Yes, and I would go as far as say is all cases are 100%. So it's all, everything is fucking gray. You know what I mean?
Like, there
is nothing black and white in this world, man. It's it all lays like right in that thing. But, you know, when you're butting up against our constitutional rights, which truly are like people don't understand how important they are until they've been violated, you know, until those are taken away from us, we just all take them for granted because you're not sitting around waking up like in the morning, like, oh God, I'm so fucking happy. I have the First Amendment and the freedom of speech. Oh, fuck it. I'm just going to go out and say all kinds of shit today. It's like people don't think about things like that. You know, I mean, it's in.
We also don't think about the protections that we do need to prevent shit like this, too. That's the other part of it. I want to talk about another story today. Aaron Spencer, this is the dad in Arkansas that rescued his daughter after she was kidnapped by a man who already had, 47 counts against him for essaying his daughter. And he was released on a low bond. And then decided to show up late at night, kidnap the daughter, and flee. Well, dad was like, where the hell did she go? They called 911. He gets in his truck, starts driving, comes across him, and gets him to pull off to the side of the road, screams, let my daughter out of the vehicle. He doesn't. The perpetrator proceeds to get out of the vehicle, approach dad, Aaron Spencer, to which he's met with gunfire, which I think almost any dad would meet someone with gunfire if you steal their child and had already been charged with violating them 47 times. And you're now approaching him in the middle of the night after the daughter is kidnapped in the perpetrator's vehicle. Well, he's being charged with second degree murder because America. That's what's going on right now. But the Lono County prosecutor is not backing down. They're not saying, you know, that was a bad idea. Maybe we shouldn't charge him with second degree murder. They've now filed new motions asking the court to play body cam video from July 8th of 2024, 3 months before the actual shooting, where Aaron Spencer is furious after learning what happened to his daughter, as any sane parent would be. I'd be concerned if the parent didn't give a shit. He told deputies he didn't trust the system. I wouldn't either. And said, sometimes you've got to handle things yourself, or something to that effect. The state now wants jurors to see that as proof of intent, a father already planning vigilante justice. The defense says it was raw emotion, not premeditation, and that when Spencer found the man under a no-contact order with his daughter in that truck at 1 a.m., it was about protection, not revenge. Bob Mott, a defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, with us. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about the body cam footage. This is something that is new to the conversation, and anything else that may be now coming to light from the state's perspective on this. Is this it? Is this all they got to stand on to say, see, it was premeditation, or is there anything else up their sleeve that we're not aware of in this story?
Well, we don't know for certain. So they had filed their motion, their response to the defense's motion in limine, and that particular motion in limine was filed in order to try to keep out those very statements that you were talking about with respect to the things that Aaron was saying when they first came in contact with him, when they became aware of the outcry, right? So there was a mandatory reporter that was at the family's house where their daughter had met Michael Fossler, who is the victim, and I'm using air quotes for those just listening, if there are those. This guy had obviously been grooming the child and then essayed her, sounds like multiple times over a period of time. And so it's obviously a raw, open, gaping wound when Aaron and Heather end up finding out about it. And, you know, they're talking to him right after he found out. One of those folks that was in that family happened to be a mandatory reporter. That's how it ends up getting reported that you know, this is what Aaron had said, you know. Mm-hmm. So that at that point, law enforcement goes to him and, you know, and Aaron's like, what do you want me to say, man? You know, it's like, you guys, you're not going to do anything about it. When's he, you know, and he kind of puts it back on it. It was a long conversation between him and two cops wherein he's kind of putting them up against the wall and saying, okay, well, what would you do in this situation? Yeah. You know, one of the cops turns around and says, well, yeah, I actually, one of my children was abused. And, you know, Aaron's like, okay, well, what happened to them? You know, did he get life in prison? No. Okay. So he's going to be out on the streets soon. Right. So like, you know, in that moment in time, which is 3 months prior to this. So this is before even that Foster gets arrested, you know, so, and this is at the point in time where they're able to talk Aaron down, you know, they talk him down. Aaron doesn't go and do anything, as much as Aaron may have wanted to go and do something at that particular time, which I think is a normal feeling for any parent.
Sure.
You know, but they're able to talk him down. They say, all right, let the law take care of this. Let's let it go through the system. And, you know, just trust the system. And he says, fine.
The system didn't work.
Mm-hmm. So, right. And, you know, the part of the, like, and if people are kind of just poking their heads and they don't know the story, ultimately Fossler's charged with, I think it was 43 different counts, varying from SA all the way down to, I think it was cyber stalking. And then, you know, possession of whatever that acronym people always use for child pornography.
CSAM, right? Or something CSAM, like that.
Yeah, like that. We just never called it that in the courtroom.
Yeah.
It's not something that ever stuck with me. But
I had to learn the other week. I'm like, what is C? I'm like, oh, that's what that is. Yeah. Kept popping up in the story. I'm like, huh?
Yeah, okay, people are always like, oh, Bob, they could tell that I'm struggling to try to remember what that acronym is. So at any rate, he ends up getting charged with it, and the very same judge that is sitting on his second degree murder case is the same judge that handled that case. She ends up giving Fossler a $50,000 bond, which means that you only have to post 10% of that in order to get out. So he only had to come up with $5,000 and he's out. And so for the next 3 months, he's out and about just living his life. And of course, he begins to groom the child, the very same victim, again, unbeknownst to the Spencers, to leading up to the night where they find out that she's not in her room because the dog is barking. They go in there, and Heather, his wife, calls 911. He's jumping in his truck to go see if he can find his daughter. And at that point, he sees like two ships passing in the night. He sees Fossler turning off this, I think it's you know, State Highway 31 on to State Highway 36, which I believe is the road that the Spencers live on.
Yeah.
So Aaron turns around. He's honking. He's flashing his lights, trying to get this guy to pull over. He's not pulling over. From what I've heard, he drives right by the Spencers' house and just keeps going. And this chase goes on for 6 miles until Aaron runs him off the road. And at that point, as you described, whatever happens there happens, and Aaron ends up shooting and killing him. And so, yeah, we've gotten to the point now where this thing's on the verge of trial. It's supposed to be going to trial, I believe, January 26th. So right after the new year. And, you know, right now they're fighting about what's going to get in and what's going to get out. I have a feeling that these statements are going to get in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that these statements hurt him. I think that the time lapse that's occurred, I think that 3 months, this wasn't a vigilante act. I get increasingly more frustrated when people try to term this as him being a vigilante, because I've done a lot of lives on this case.
Yeah.
And I get very perturbed when people start saying that it was a vigilante thing. I'm like, if it would have been a vigilante thing,
he'd be dead.
Aaron Spencer would have gone over there the day that he bonded out to take care of business. You know, that's not what occurred. Nothing occurred. And I don't care how she was taken out of the house, whether it was by her
that
walking
too.
Out. You know, that's the other thing, man.
That's a curious question that people ask. And I'm always like, it's a child. Yeah. It's right. A child you're talking about. You're talking about a 72-year-old man getting a, how old was she?
At the time of the first essay, she was 13. At the time
13? Yeah.
She's 14.
Getting a 13, 14-ish-year-old out of a, out, convincing her to leave her house in some way, shape, or form. A child. There's no equation here where this is, oh, she's making an informed decision in her best interests. That's preying on a child. It does. I don't care if he literally kidnapped her and pulled her out of the house with a bag over her head, or if she walked out on free will. It's the same damn thing.
I agree.
It doesn't matter.
So disgusting.
I could not agree more. But so when we were digging into the case the other night, and Allie kind of, she was devil's advocating during that live, and mm-hmm. she was like, well, you know, because some of the stuff that came out that was pretty interesting in terms of like getting a bird's eye or a little bit of a sneak peek at what the state's case is going to be is that, you know, obviously they have Aaron's phone and his data mm-hmm. from his phone. And, you know, there's inconsistencies with the fact of him saying because they were asking, why didn't you call 911? He's like, oh, I didn't use my phone. I was chasing some guy at 70 miles an hour that had my daughter in the truck. And they're like, oh, well, you know, here we looked at his phone records and he made a phone call, you know, at some point during a minute and 16-minute phone call or 16-second phone call during the chase. So, you know, he wasn't being truthful. He did, in fact, use his phone. And then before he ends up calling 911, he texts his wife twice or called his wife or called somebody at the house or called somebody, at on his wife's phone, presumably his wife, which is exactly what I'd be doing. Right. You know, like after the thing's done, before I call 911.
Didn't she already call 911? Weren't they already aware of this?
On the phone with 911. Yep.
So why would he call again?
Exactly.
He's stuck in the moment. He's dealing with what he's dealing with right then and there. He's not going to be like, maybe I should call the police. No, he is after his freaking daughter.
Right. 100%. It's so easy for people to sit on their couches with their phone in their hand, listening to cases like this, or, you know, sitting on their computer and watching us on the big screen while they're sitting in their couch and sipping a Starbucks and saying, oh, well, that's not what I would do. You have no idea what you would do unless you are in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
I reject anybody telling me what the proper response is in that situation, unless they have lived it. If you've lived it, I'm listening. How did you respond? Okay, well, you're not Aaron Spencer. We're all different. We all have a different trauma response.
The whole thing, he's taking the law into his own hands. No, he's taking his daughter's life into his own
Correct.
Hands because the law has already failed on that part. The law
she
has already dropped
at
the
that
ball.
Moment. Yeah, no. She was in trouble right then and there. He is watching it. His body is responding to his child about to be whatevered.
Exactly.
You know, so he is responding in that moment. It's not like, well, I'm going to go get that guy after the fact. No, he is watching it happen live.
100%. And you know, so I got into this discussion the other night wherein when we pull up the statute and we're looking at the statute and what they're going to employ is a self-defense, but really defense of others' defense, okay? And in that mm-hmm. thing, the first kind of hurdle that you have to get over in terms of employing that defense successfully is that Aaron cannot have been the initial aggressor, which clearly no one has been able to put forth any kind of argument whatsoever that Aaron was the initial aggressor. You cannot make the argument that him forcing him off the road makes him the initial aggressor because that's not right.
He stole his kid from his house. That's the aggressive move.
Exactly. At the point in time that he sees him drive by with his daughter in the vehicle, to me, that's when the clock starts. People mm-hmm. keep wanting to talk about the fact of, okay, well, and I'm talking about the clock in terms of determining whether or not Aaron Spencer was reasonable in his actions. And they're going back to, and the state in terms of what they filed is, again, giving us a sneak peek of what they're going to try and employ at trial. And the thing that they're going to say is that Aaron had reason to know, okay, that she hadn't been kidnapped, that she left on her own accord. Tony, I know where you're going to go. She was 14. Mm-hmm. She was a child. I'm 100% with you. This is the argument that they're going to be trying to put forth. Now, there is a problem with that in the state of Arkansas, wherein at the age of 14 in that state, kidnapping does not apply.
What?
Yeah, dude, it's crazy. It's crazy. Like, Allison pulled it up in terms of, like, you can actually, if they're at the age of 14, they can consent to, like, leaving, where it's not considered kidnapping, even if she goes out of the house on her own accord. But none of that matters, because what they're arguing is that he had reason to know because she had used a stuffed animal, at least in theory, to make it seem as if she was still in bed. But none of that matters to me, where this thing starts, because Aaron doesn't know if that's just her sneaking out of the house. He doesn't necessarily, I mean, would he probably immediately think, oh, this guy got her again? Maybe. Possibly.
If you're a responsible parent, it doesn't even fucking matter if she's gone. Right. If she snuck out of the house, you're still going and looking for her. You're not like, oh, she put the stuffed animal there. She just snuck out in the middle of the night. Let's go watch a rerun of SNL. No.
Exactly my point. Because
you're going to go find your daughter, because it could be she snuck out. That's not okay. Or it could be that the creepy perv convinced her to come out too. It's one of the two. And neither are okay.
Neither, and so in my estimation, because of exactly what you said, where this thing starts in terms of kind of looking at the analysis of whether or not the defense of others is going to work, is it starts exactly when he lays eyes on the fact that his child is once again in that guy's truck.
Yeah.
That is when the clock starts for Aaron Spencer, because that is when he realizes what is going on. It doesn't matter legally how she got out of the house. The state's going to try to make it matter, but the defense is going to be able to argue, no. She just could have snuck. I don't know, man.
Why do they just keep digging into this? Are they prepared for the courthouse to burn to the ground if this guy gets off? Because I think the villagers are going to be there with flames.
But here's the thing, you guys, and I don't want to like drill down like our entire conversation wasn't worthy, because it absolutely is. But at the end of the day, the jurors are community members, their parents, their siblings. Are they going to sit there and let this monster loose? They're going to sit there and say, what if this happened to my child? What if this happened to my sister? What if this happened to me?
Are they? Because one state over, they just said to Jesse in Oklahoma, you know what? We don't care about those two 16-year-old girls that USA'd and nearly killed. Second chance, you're a good baseball player. So keep in mind the mindset of some folks in these parts.
I guess I want to believe that people are different than that.
There's plenty that are. But when you get a group, you know, together, you get a few in there that think very differently, very questionably differently than the rest, that you go, if there was only a true record of everything you've done in your life, I don't think you'd be a free human being. And they tend to think like this.
Yeah. To me, this is kind of the inverse of what it normally is, where it's oftentimes that I've felt that it's going to be very tough for the defense to be able to impanel 12 people that are going to be behind our client. Right. This is a situation where I think it's going to be very, very difficult for the state to get 12 people in that box that are going to be able to look at the situation any differently than what it actually was, which is what they're asking people to do in this case. They're asking people to just disregard everything that preceded it and look at this thing in a vacuum in terms of what happened in that moment in time. And, you know, the defense has a lot of bullets to shoot in terms of that particular aspect of the case, because they're going to be able to lay out the story. Now, they're not going to be if you know, and we've heard Fossler, it's alleged this isn't the first time he's done it. The dude was 67 years old, man. Like you just don't start you just don't start essaying children and abusing kids at 67. This, I'm sure, you know, when we start getting more and more information about this guy, this was not something that had just cropped up. This is going to be a thing where you're going to find that he was doing it to other people in the past, and that was
guaranteed
the person that he was. However, none of that's relevant to this case because Aaron didn't know it. Where the clock starts for Aaron is the minute that he finds out that this guy was abusing his daughter. That's like his knowledge base. Cause you like the whole question was Aaron Spencer reasonable in his belief that he believed that Foster was going to either commit a felony against his child or harm his child? And I think that the state is going to be hard pressed to convince anybody in that set of circumstances that that's not exactly what was going on there. Either he was going to commit another essay, or he was going to commit an essay and then kill her, or he was just going to kill her because, frankly, she was the only evidence that they had against him in his 43 counts in terms of anything beyond the stuff that they found on the devices. In terms of the essays, she's the witness because all of those crimes he was charged with are related to her.
Hope there's no closeted predators on that jury that are gonna find some sort of commiseration here with this guy. Because I think that's the way you get a hung jury it's probably where you get a hung jury, on something like this. But they're out there. Look, they are out there. I did this case. I talked about it, on Morning Radio Live in Northeast Wisconsin about a week or two ago. And we took some live calls and such, and you'd be surprised. I mean, I was getting some callers saying that they were on the guy's side it's like, and I was taken aback. I was like, how is anyone seeing it that way? How what sort of twisted prism is working in someone's mind where they're going, I think the dad might be at fault here.
Did you push back? Did you try to say?
Oh yeah. My pushback was like, I really question how anyone could see that, because I go back to my tried and true phrase of only predators protect predators. I don't see any other way why someone would see this in a different way unless you just fully did not grasp all of the details of this case, which may be. People are very selective in what they pick up on.
Guessing it's that. It has
I'm hoping.
To be that,
I'm
right?
hoping. I am hoping.
Maybe they popped in late. They heard that this guy,
I'm hoping. I'm hoping, but you never know. You never know.
You never know what a jury is going to do. That is the only certainty in the law, is that you just never know what a jury is going to do. And it's why it's a terrifying proposition. You know, that is why people will plead out on cases where, not necessarily for a homicide, but, you know, cases wherein, you know, you could do 6 to 10 years on a serious felony and you didn't do it. But, you know, the state's offering you, we'll give you a year, and your lawyer's telling you, well, look, man, I know you're telling me you didn't do it, and I believe you. However, this evidence that they have, they might be able to convince a jury that you did do it, and you're looking at a hell of a lot more time than you'd be getting if you took this plea. I mean, it happens every day in every courthouse in this country where people plead to things that they didn't do because either the state, especially if they're not offering any jail time. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, yeah.
Never know. There's no slam dunks, though this one sure as hell feels like one. Yeah. But at this point, anything is possible.
Yeah, and you know who it definitely doesn't feel like a slam dunk to, T, is the Spencer family.
Yeah, without
doubt. They're going through it, man. It's brutal.
It is. Bob Mata, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. Check it out wherever you get podcasts. Check out the YouTube channel Defense Diaries. Just search it on YouTube and you will find it. And Buried, yes. What episode are you up to as of right now? 11?
Episode 12 dropped.
12. Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh, okay.
This morning. So, yes. Buried. Inside the John Wayne Gacy investigation. That's it.
Yes. check it out, if you, especially if you've been watching the Peacock.
Devil in Disguise.
Yes, we had them on the show. Have you had them on your show yet?
Sure. No, I'm working it out. It sounds like Churn's going to be coming on the next couple of weeks, so I'm excited about that.
Nice. Yeah. That'll be a good conversation. You can also go back in our archive and find that conversation. Michael Chernus is with us and discussing that that case as well. But do check out Buried Inside the John Wayne Gacy Investigation wherever you get podcasts. Until next time, for Stacey, Todd, and Bob, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.